Penguin Random House Audio presents On the Natural History of Destruction by W. G. Zeebout, translated by Anthea Bell, read for you by Simon Vance. Forward. The lectures on literature and the air raids of the Second World War in this volume are not printed exactly as I delivered them in the late autumn of 1997. The idea behind the first lecture came from Carl Seelig's account of an excursion he made in the summer of 1943 with Robert Walser, then a patient in a mental hospital, on the very day before the night when the city of Hamburg went up in flames. Seelig's reminiscences, which make no reference at all to this coincidence, gave me a clearer view of the perspective from which I myself look back on the terrible events of those years. Born in a village in the Allgäu Alps in May 1944, I'm one of those who remained almost untouched by the catastrophe then unfolding in the German Reich. In my first Zurich lecture, I tried to show, through passages of some length taken from my own literary works, that this catastrophe had nonetheless left its mark on my mind. On that occasion, such an approach could be justified, since the ostensible subject of my lectures was poetics. In the version presented here, however, extensive self-quotation would be inappropriate. I have therefore merely used parts of my first lecture in a postscript, which also deals with the reactions to what I said in Zurich and the correspondence that I subsequently received. Much of the response was rather bizarre in character. However, the inadequate and inhibited nature of the letters and other writings sent to me showed, in itself, that the sense of unparalleled national humiliation felt by millions in the last years of the war had never really found verbal expression, and that those directly affected by the experience neither shared it with each other nor passed it on to the next generation. The recurrent complaint that no one, to the present day, has written the great German epic of the wartime and post-war periods is not unconnected with this failure, which in some ways is entirely understandable, given the force of the absolute uncertainty that emerged from our order-loving minds. In spite of strenuous efforts to come to terms with the past, as people like to put it, it seems to me that we Germans today are a nation strikingly blind to history and lacking in tradition. We do not feel any passionate interest in our earlier way of life and the specific features of our own civilization, of the kind universally perceptible, for instance, in the culture of the British Isles. And when we turn to take a retrospective view, particularly of the years 1930 to 1950, we are always looking and looking away at the same time. As a result, the works produced by German authors after the war are often marked by a half-consciousness or false consciousness designed to consolidate the extremely precarious position of those writers in a society that was morally almost entirely discredited. To the overwhelming majority of the writers who stayed on in Germany under the Third Reich, the redefinition of their idea of themselves after 1945 was a more urgent business than depiction of the real conditions surrounding them. The case of Alfred Andersch was a good example of the unfortunate consequences in literary practice, and for that reason the essay on him which I published in Lettres a few years ago is reprinted here after the lectures on air war and literature. At the time it earned me several sharp reprimands from people unwilling to see that, as the apparently inexorable power of the fascist regime was deployed, a basic stance of opposition and a lively intelligence, characteristics undoubtedly typical of Andersch, could easily turn into more or less deliberate attempts to conform, and that later a man in the public eye, like Andersch, would therefore have to adjust his presentation of his career through tactful omissions and other revisions. In my view, such a preoccupation with retrospective improvement of the self-image they wished to hand down was one of the main reasons for the inability of a whole generation of German authors to describe what they had seen and to convey it to our minds. Translator's Note. This is the foreword as written for the German edition of the book published by Hansa in 1999. The English edition, it will be seen, also includes essays on Jean Emery and Peter Weiss, which were not part of the original German publication. I have no doubt that if he had lived to see the final text of the full translation, he had already approved the whole of the earlier part, W.G. Sebot would have revised or added to the foreword in order to include mention of those two authors. Air War and Literature. Zurich Lectures. The trick of elimination is every expert's defensive reflex. Stanislaw Lem, Imaginary Magnitude. 1. Today, it is hard to form an even partly adequate idea of the extent of the devastation suffered by the cities of Germany in the last years of the Second World War. Still harder to think about the horrors involved in that devastation. It is true that the strategic bombing surveys published by the Allies, together with the records of the Federal German Statistics Office and other official sources, show that the Royal Air Force alone dropped 1 million tons of bombs on enemy territory. It is true that of the 131 towns and cities attacked, some only once and some repeatedly, many were almost entirely flattened. That about 600,000 German civilians fell victim to the air raids, and that 3.5 million homes were destroyed, while at the end of the war, 7.5 million people were left homeless, and there were 31.1 cubic metres of rubble for every person in Cologne, and 42.8 cubic metres for every inhabitant of Dresden. But we do not grasp what it all actually meant. The destruction, on a scale without historical precedent, entered the annals of the nation as it set about rebuilding itself only in the form of vague generalizations. It seems to have left scarcely a trace of pain behind in the collective consciousness. It has been largely obliterated from the retrospective understanding of those affected, and it never played any appreciable part in the discussion of the internal constitution of our country. As Alexander Kluger later confirmed, it never became an experience capable of public decipherment. This is highly paradoxical in view of the large numbers of people exposed to the campaign day after day, month after month, year after year, and the length of time well into the post-war period during which they still faced its real consequences, which might have been expected to stifle any positive attitude to life. Despite the enormous efforts whereby some kind of practicable modus vivendi was restored after every attack, even after 1950, wooden crosses still stood on the piles of rubble in towns like Pforzheim, which lost almost one-third of its 60,000 inhabitants in a single raid on the night of February 22, 1945. And no doubt the appalling smells which, as Janet Flanner wrote in March 1947, were released from the yawning cellars of Warsaw by the first warm spring weather, pervaded the German cities too in the immediate post-war period. But these things obviously did not register on the sensory experience of the survivors still living on the scene of the catastrophe. People walked down the street and past the dreadful ruins, wrote Alfred Döblin in 1945, after returning from his American exile to southwest Germany, as if nothing had happened and the town had always looked like that. The reverse side of such apathy was the declaration of a new beginning, the unquestioning heroism with which people immediately set about the task of clearance and reorganization. A booklet devoted to the city of Worms in 1945 to 1955 says that the hour called for upright men of impeccable conduct and aims, almost all of whom would be in the front line of reconstruction for years to come. This booklet, written by one Willy Ruppert for the municipal authorities, included many photographs. They make it look as if the image of total destruction was not the horrifying end of a collective aberration, but something more like the first stage of a brave new world. Writing of a conversation with the directors of IG Farben in Frankfurt in April 1945, Robert Thomas Pell records the amazement with which he heard Germans stating their intention of rebuilding their country to be greater and stronger than ever before, in a tone in which self-pity, grovelling self-justification, a sense of injured innocence and defiance were curiously intermingled. Nor did they subsequently fail to carry out that intention, as witness the postcards that travellers in Germany can buy today at the newsstands of Frankfurt am Main. From the outset, the now legendary and in some respects genuinely admirable reconstruction of the country after the devastation wrought by Germany's wartime enemies a reconstruction tantamount to a second liquidation in successive phases of the nation's own past history, prohibited...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?